Hello, and welcome to the Community Mennonite Church Podcast. This week's sermon is brought to us by Pastor Dana Olson Getty.
I moved here to Harrisonburg about a year and a half ago, and before that, we lived for 9 years in the Walltown neighborhood of Durham, North Carolina. Walltown is a 100-year-old neighborhood. It's made up of one-story shotgun houses, modest little bungalows that are built by nonprofits, simple houses. The streets are lined with big, shady old trees. There's a park and a community center that was recently built by the city. It replaced one that the neighborhood actually put up themselves when, in the 70s, the city refused to build a community center for this poor, mostly African-American neighborhood. Walltown was built, this neighborhood that we lived in, was built originally to house servants who moved to Durham to work at Duke University, which is located just one block from the edge of Walltown. And to this day, if you talk to Walltown old-timers, they'll refer to the Duke campus as the plantation. Life in Walltown was an immersion in contrasts. So kids who grow up there, they get first dibs on one of the very best and most hotly sought-after primary schools in the city. They live within blocks of a world-class university with all the resources that it has to offer. And within their neighborhood, there are many adults who are deeply committed to young people, to the community, who have years and years of experience and wisdom of how to live faithfully as God's beloved people under the reign of poverty and racial oppression. But these kids in Walltown, these kids that Eric and Noah and I grew to love, they also have to deal with occasional drive-by shootings, with the temptation to join the guys on the corner who are carrying guns and selling drugs. Walltown kids are a prime target for the school-to-prison pipeline. Police harassment and racial profiling are commonplace. And by high school, a significant number of kids are failing out or have dropped out. There are few prospects for gainful or legal employment, especially for the young men who grew up in Walltown. It is a community that has some pretty serious needs, but it's also a beautiful community. It's filled with abundance and goodness and joy. So one sunny Saturday morning, I was hanging out in my pajamas in my duplex in Walltown, and I responded to a knock at the door. There were two teenagers on the porch. They were kids I did not recognize. The older one was dressed in a button-down shirt, a tie. He had shine shoes. He greeted me politely, and then he abruptly blurted out, "Do you know where you would go if you died today?" I glanced over his shoulder, and I could see similar pairs of young people knocking on doors up and down the block. And at the end of the block, this big, white, 15-passenger van with the name of a church from another part of the city written prominently on the side. And a flash of anger radiated through my body. Who was teaching these teenagers that this impersonal and insulting form of evangelism was something they should be undertaking? Why had they chosen our neighborhood? Did they not know how many, many of our neighbors were lifelong followers of Jesus, faithful through the most difficult of circumstances? Did they have no idea that on Sunday afternoon you can't even drive through that street for all of the people and music and conversation spilling out of the steps of the St. John's Missionary Baptist Church? Did they not know that our neighborhood was filled to the brim with people like our next-door neighbor, Miss Roxanna, She was an elderly widow. She's since passed away. But it was known throughout the neighborhood that any hungry person who came to her door, no matter if they were high, no matter if they were delusional with mental illness, no matter if they were scamming for drug money, they would be fed, because we're all God's children. Did this church have no idea about the weekly potlucks, the summer block parties, the reunions, when friendship and laughter and testimonies of God's goodness through the years filled the streets of our neighborhood? And did they not know that this was a neighborhood who had taken the enormous risk of welcoming young, privileged white Christians who wanted to learn how to follow Jesus faithfully in a racially divided world? Did they not know this was a neighborhood that had welcomed refugees, held an annual summer camp for youth to teach entrepreneurial skills and Christian discipleship? This neighborhood matched high schoolers with volunteer mentors for homework help. Could they not see that these streets were overflowing with joy, companionship, and goodness of God's new community in Jesus? So I turned back to this teenage evangelist, and I retorted, "Even better, I know where I am now." He was startled and confused. He hastily pushed a pamphlet with the sinner's prayer and his church's address into my hand and said goodbye. But as the day went on, I realized more and more how true that momentary quick comeback, which I don't usually have, but how true that was. This is a neighborhood filled with people that outsiders might see as needy. But I had found myself smack dab in the middle of this big, noisy, joy-filled community of people gathered around the sweet wine of God's new community. And I had spent enough time with these people to know that this was one of the best things I had ever tasted. I found myself startled, even angry, when others couldn't recognize this abundance and joy and beauty that was right in front of them. So this story we heard about the wedding in Cana has a similar kind of experience of contrast. Jesus and his mother and some of his disciples were at a wedding in the little dusty village of Cana. So weddings in this time were public events. They weren't necessarily religious in the way they are for us now. But the friends and family of the bride would gather in the bride's home, and the women would help her dress in her finery, and then they would all proceed through the streets in a torchlit procession to the groom's house, where his family would have prepared a lavish feast. And then this initial wedding banquet was followed by 7 more days of feasting and drinking for all the wedding guests. So as you can imagine, it was quite expensive to host a gathering like this. In fact, it was so expensive that most peasant families couldn't afford to do it on their own. So they often formed these kind of cooperative mutual aid societies. Whenever someone in the network had a family wedding, everyone was obligated to send some money or some supplies to help with the feast. That way, everyone would have enough when it was their turn to have a family wedding. So if you ran out of wine at your wedding, it wasn't just a cause for embarrassment. This is a shame-honor culture, and a failure like this could actually lead to a loss of reputation and a stigma that might even pass down to subsequent generations. It's a pretty serious problem. It was a lack that revealed that not only were you poor, but you were poor in relationships. You had no peers or patrons who were willing to bring some wine and save your reputation. So in the midst of this celebration, these two families coming together with the marriage of their children, there's this sudden and severe lack. And Mary pulls Jesus aside, and she informs them there's no wine. They've poured the last glass and someone drank it. It's all gone. This party is about to come to a screeching halt. So in coming to Jesus, Mary is brokering on behalf of this family. It's not entirely clear what she expects Jesus to do about this problem, but she clearly is asking him to do something to salvage the reputation of this family, and in doing so, to possibly enhance the reputation of his own family, her family. Jesus has some initial resistance to this idea, but then he responds. He tells the servants to fill 6 stone water jars with water. So these are huge jars. They would have been waist high, and together they held 120 to 180 gallons. So filling them with water, that's no small chore. But the servants did it. And when these jars were just full to the very brim, Jesus instructed one of the servants to bring a cup of the water to the head waiter. And somewhere along the way, somewhere in there, a miracle occurred. The water turned into wine, and it wasn't just any old wine. This is not Trader Joe wine. This is rich, delectable, exquisite wine. This is royalty wedding wine. And there's so much of it. So if we went to buy this much wine at the wine shop, we need to buy between 600 and 900 bottles. The group gathered for this wedding couldn't possibly drink that much wine, even if they drank themselves silly. So the head waiter is astonished. Why would a groom wait until several days into the wedding when everyone is too intoxicated to appreciate the complexity and nuance of this fabulous wine to serve it to his guests? The head waiter's mouth is filled with this rich, delicious sweetness, but he has no idea where it came from or how it came to be available at this wedding. If you haven't caught it yet, this is a somewhat scandalous story. Jesus made a lot of wine for some people who are already tipsy. And as I learned from Rita Finger this morning, who's an expert on this gospel, putting wine into a stone purification jar was also a way of breaking the purity laws. Wine ferments, it has life in it, and it was put in these jars that were meant only for water for purification. So Jesus is kind of breaking some rules here, not doing what we would expect. On the first read-through, you might think this is a really cool party trick. Maybe there are some college students who'd want to invite Jesus to their frat party. Or if you take the dynamics of shame and honor into account, it's a story about Jesus saving a first century family from some pretty serious loss of face and honor. But as I read and listened to this story, I heard something more. I think this is Jesus' divine coming out story. He's telling us about who he is in turning this water into abundant, delicious, royalty-worthy wine. Jesus is telling us something essential about who he is, what his purpose in life is, his true identity. He's saying for all those who have eyes to see that the feast of God's kingdom is not sometime in the distant future or after I die. It's right here, right now, in front of us, at a peasant wedding, in the midst of a serious social and material need, in a country still living under the oppressive reign of the Romans. With this delicious and extravagant wine, Jesus is saying that in him, God is present. The era of God's reign has begun here, now. The prophets in the Old Testament used this image of superabundance of wine as an image of God's reign. In fact, they sometimes talked about the hills and the mountains running with wine. They were using that to tell us about the time when Israel's fortunes would be restored, when they'd be freed from foreign rule, when God would rule over them directly, providing abundantly, justly for all. And this symbol of wine as a sign of God's reign, it was so recognizable that when Jews revolted in the first century against Romans and tried to set up an alternative government where Jews would rule Jews, they actually put wine cups and grapes as symbols on their coins, as a sign of the reign of God. So this presence of abundant amounts of exquisite wine at this wedding is a sign of God's reign come here and now, of the joy and delight in life that God has promised to God's people. This divine life of God is present at this wedding, spilling over, it's filling to overflowing all the cups, filling every guest's mouth with delicious, intoxicating joy. Where is that intoxicating, delicious, celebrating joy of God's kingdom among us? This promise of Jesus turning water into wine is that the joy and life of God's presence is here and now in the ordinary stuff of our everyday lives, in the very moments of our greatest need. When we're most in need, when we've run out of hope or patience or strength or courage, God is waiting to meet our need and replace our lack with abundance. When we are interceding on behalf of neighbors who are suffering from a lack of relationship, justice, resources, Jesus is waiting to turn the ordinary stuff of our everyday lives into a sign of his kingdom, into a delicious, abundant, beautiful feast. When we're most in need, when we're feeling our lack, it's hard to see how that's possible. But I think Mary shows us the way. She comes to Jesus. She doesn't know how he'll respond, but she lays this need out before him. It's not even her need. It's the need of another family, and yet she tells him about this lack. And he responds in a way she could never have envisioned. The need is met, but Jesus does so much more. He turns this ordinary wedding into a celebration of God's reign, of God's new community in this place. He turns severe and serious lack into an occasion for intoxicating joy. Jesus is inviting us to bring our needs and lacks as well. The thing that we most need, we most long for, we feel most desperate for. He's inviting us to bring the needs of our neighbors and our friends, the things that seem impossibly absent. How could they ever be provided for? And then God is inviting us, when the need is met, to join in this delicious, intoxicating celebration of the reign of God's new community around the feast of God's presence among us. May it be so.
Thank you for listening to the Community Mennonite Church podcast. Our theme music is a setting of John Wesley's text, Jesus, I Believe You're Near, composed by Matt Carlson. Jeremy Nafziger arranged it for strings. To learn more about our congregation or to plan a visit, please check out our website at cmcva.org.